The power of art in times of crisis.
Art becomes communication, and the love of art and the communion that these people feel, it is beyond language. And then beyond art is love, as some of the people in the group began to fall in love. And so it's about levels of communication, but yes, it's also about how we lean into art in hard times. And it's interesting, in my own life, in the last couple of years, I have had many, many moments of thinking, oh, what is the point? Literary fiction, really, the house is on fire. What is the point? And I woke up this morning, November 7th, and thought, art is the point. Yes, yes, times are hard, and it's my responsibility to tell a story. It's my responsibility to gather people around the fire and unite us with a story. So I do think that in critical moments, art really does surge forward.
That's novelist Ann Patchett. We talk with her about the new annotated version of her 2001 novel, Bel Canto, and about how art and human connection can help us survive in turbulent times. Then poet and activist Kathy Engel talks about poetry in the service of social justice. Her new poetry volume is Dear Inheritors. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The first edition of Ann Patchett's celebrated novel, Bel Canto, was published on September 11, 2001. The latest edition came out on Election Day 2024. In both cases, it was apt timing, because Bel Canto is all about the power of art to inspire solidarity and compassion between people, regardless of their seemingly unsurmountable divisions. It's a reminder of what can nourish the soul and create community in times of terrible crisis. In this special annotated edition, Patchett opens the story to readers, providing enlightening commentary on her original version, including reflections on her narrative choices and style. Looking back at her younger self, Ann Patchett takes us deep into her creative process and considers her career and growth as an artist. I spoke with Ann Patchett 2 days after Election Day. We spoke about our dismay at the results, but also about how to counter hate and division with compassion and beauty, both critical to the resistance to tyranny. Ann Patchett, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
This annotated version of your 2001, published 2001 novel, Bel Canto, is such a wonderful gift to anybody who wants to better understand the process of writing a novel, or even of writing anything. I found it so fascinating and useful, but it was also an incredibly brave thing to do, it seems to me, because you're showing all your mistakes to the public.
Well, it's funny because a couple of my friends have said that, like, ooh, would you really want people to know? And I'm like, well, it's published with those mistakes. So it's not like I'm putting fresh mistakes in there. I'm just acknowledging the mistakes that are there already. And hey, isn't this a great time to acknowledge mistakes?
Why is that?
I guess I feel that there are some people who don't ever acknowledge that they've done something wrong. And it's something that I hear about a lot with children and with young people. They don't ever want to acknowledge that they've made mistakes. And I think acknowledging that you've made mistakes is actually a very beautiful and human thing. It's like, look what I did. Look, I did this wrong. I won't do this wrong again. I'm going to learn. You can also learn from my mistakes. It seems open-hearted to me.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly it is. I mean, even though there are mistakes in the book, I'm sure most of the readers just didn't even pick up as mistakes. But it is really so wonderful to see. So there are comments on a number of different levels. There are comments just on things like, you know, copy editing, basically, or taking out adjectives or taking out adverbs. You know, the kind of thing I remember with the book that I'm writing, I did a search on words that end in L-Y. So I was able to track them all down.
That's actually a great tip. I'm going to do that.
Oh, that's great. So why did you decide to do this, though, 20-some years after this was published?
So a little bookstore outside of Boston called Newtonville Books had been hard hit by the pandemic. They're tiny, and they had taken on a lot of debt. And so the owners decided to ask a group of writers to hand annotate one of their books, and that they would sell those books in an auction to raise money. And I own a bookstore, Parnassus Books in Nashville, and that sounded like a great idea to me. And I said yes. And one of the strange things about me is that I am the opposite of whatever a procrastinator is. So we had about 5 or 6 months to do the assignment. And I, of course, did my homework immediately. And I finished in September, and it wasn't due until January. And this was all last year, last calendar year. So I finished the book, and instead of mailing it in, I thought, well, you know, I have it until January. I'll just put it away. I was on book tour for Tom Lake. And when I came back, I looked at it again, getting ready to pack it up and mail it. And I thought, oh, I don't want to do this. So it was Tom Lake that I annotated. And I said, I don't like the idea of giving this thing away. It seems like a valuable document to me. I learned a lot from the process of annotating it, and I had a really good time doing it. And I didn't like the idea that it was going to go off to belong to one person and I would never know where it was. And so I decided to make a copy. And instead of Xeroxing it, I got another copy of the book out. And over the course of 3 days, I re-hand wrote all of my annotations into the second copy. And that's where I really started to see what I had done. And I thought, this is a very interesting document. It really shows how I wrote a novel. And so I took the copy and I sent it to my editor, Jonathan Burnham at HarperCollins. And I said, do you think that we could do something with this? Not Tom Lake, because that was too recent. But what if I did another one of my books? And then what if it was successful, we could ask a series of HarperCollins authors whose books had been important and had also earned out, and they had some distance of time, if they wanted to do this, and we could do a series of Harper annotated books. So that was my grand master plan. And my editor and I decided it was between the Dutch House and Bel Canto, and I decided that I would do Bel Canto. And when I was halfway through, I started thinking, as someone who owns a bookstore, there's not going to be anything coming out on election day. All books are published on Tuesday. And the Tuesday of November 5th was going to be practically nothing. And I thought, all right, instead of trying to get together a series right away, I'm going to just put the pedal down. I'm going to do this. And I'm going to bring this book out on November 5th so bookstores can have something to sell. And maybe, hopefully, people could have a little nice thing, as my beloved mother-in-law used to say, a happy. It would be a little happy. And so that's how it all came about, and how it came about pretty fast.
And I'm so glad that you did, actually, because as I told you before we started recording this interview, reading this book has been a balm to my soul after you know, just the shocking and incomprehensible events of Tuesday.
Yeah, it's a very tender book. And that was one of the things that really struck me when I read it, because I hadn't read it in 24 years. People don't, for the most part, go back and reread their own published work. It is a very tender book, very sincere, very without guile. And basically, it's people who are put into a horrible situation, and they respond to it with love and kindness and communication and art and an appreciation of beauty and of life. And not some of them, but all of them respond to the crisis in that way.
You know, it's interesting because as you say that, and even in the book, as I was reading it, it put me in mind of the book by Rebecca Solnit that's called A Paradise Built in Hell. I don't know if you've ever heard of it or read it.
I haven't read it. I've read a lot of Rebecca Solnit. Boy, there's a lot of Rebecca Solnit floating around on the internet right now, but I haven't read that one.
The premise of her book is that people come together in times of extraordinary tragedy and crisis. And, you know, it struck me so much because it really does make me think that we have an opportunity to come together in this time.
Mm.
But I want to go back to your book because I have so many questions about it. And we are speaking with Anne Patchett about the annotated version of her novel Bel Canto, which was originally published in 2001. You know, in the original, you tell people within the first few pages what the outcome would be, that the hostages would survive, but the terrorists would not. And we should say for those of our readers who haven't read the book, it's about...
Yeah, so you're not giving it away. That sentence comes on page 13, and it's about a birthday party for a famous Japanese businessman, Katsumi Hosokawa, in an unnamed South American country. It takes place in the vice president's home, and it's a celebration of people all around the world, but it's also that they're trying to get him to come and build a factory in their country. And in the middle of the party, when the famous opera singer Roxanne Koss is singing, a group of terrorists burst in and take over the party. And so the book takes place during the 4 months of their confinement when this hostage situation is going on.
Right. And so I wonder, first of all, why did you give this away so soon? And second of all, you say in your handwritten note that this is a sentence that most people overlook or forget. Why do you think they forget it? It seems impossible to forget.
And yet they do. So that's kind of two questions. One, why did I put it in there? And two, why do people overlook it? I put it in there on something that I refer to as the love story principle for anybody who is old enough to remember the book or the movie of Love Story. It opens up the movie with Ryan O'Neal sitting in a baseball park, and he says, "What can you say about Jenny? She loved baseball and Bach and Beethoven and me. Jenny's dead." And then we go back into when they first meet, their courtship, their love. So you're not watching that movie wondering if Jenny's going to make it. Jenny's not going to make it. She's absolutely not going to make it. It's the first thing we know. So what we are then forced to do, instead of putting our energy into wondering, we are forced to pay attention to her life, not wonder about the outcome of her life. And that's what I'm trying to do. But also on a larger note, it's we are all going to die. Stop wondering about that. Stop wondering about how it's going to end. It's absolutely going to end. Pay attention to the life and to the beauty of the life. As far as people reading it and then forgetting it, it is the same as we manage to forget pretty much every day that we are going to die. And so we don't pay attention to our life and how beautiful and rare and precious it is, because we're racing ahead to what we want and what we didn't get, and all the time we believe that we have.
Yeah, and time is so central to this novel. You talk about how the novel is very much about time, about time stopping. I mean, after all, in this situation, people are taken out of their lives, which is something that makes you pay attention to what is going on around you, even if you're not in a kidnapping situation. So talk about the notions of time in this novel and what happens to it.
Yeah, it is a book about the suspension of time. And that's why it was such a hard book for me to write. They come in, there's this big, huge burst of activity, and then they're just waiting. They're waiting for something to happen. Everybody's waiting. And a fog comes in and comes down over the house. We never see any action beyond the wall around the property. We don't know what the plans are on the other side. At one point, Gen, one of the characters in the book, gives his watch away, and then no one has any idea. And there are several points in the book in which you think, wait, how long ago did that happen? Wait, they found this out 3 weeks ago? Has she been singing for a month now? How long is that? And then at the very end, when everything falls apart, suddenly time comes rushing back. There's a little clock on a mantelpiece that starts to chime again. And there we are. We're back in life. We are no longer suspended in an idol.
So the book is Bel Canto is about the suspension of time, but also about the role of art in a time of crisis. And as we are speaking on November 7th, 2024, 2 days after, you know, very possible ending of the country that we've known and heard about for 270 years. And by that, I mean the suspension of even the idea of the rule of law. Talk about, now I lost my train of thought.
You just went to a really dark place.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm okay. You can tell it's top of mind.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, art.
I actually think we're going to be okay. I want you to know that. I think we're going to be okay.
So the novel is about the suspension of time, as you said, and what happens within that kind of space, how it allows for the kind of attention and tenderness and the opening of authentic relationships between people. It's also about the role of art in a time of crisis. So tell us about that. Tell us about how your character, Roxanne Koss, at a certain moment, she takes control of the proceedings, and that is art taking control. Tell us about that.
So this is an international group of people, and they don't have a common language. There is a translator who is doing his best and being worked to the bone because everyone needs him for every level of communication. But then there's also an opera singer, and eventually she becomes the mode of communication. Art becomes communication, and the love of art and the communion that these people feel, it is beyond language. And then beyond art is love, as some of the people in the group began to fall in love. And so it's about levels of communication, but yes, it's also about how we lean into art in hard times. And it's interesting, in my own life in the last couple of years, I have had many, many moments of thinking, oh, what is the point? Literary fiction, really, the house is on fire. What is the point? And I woke up this morning, November 7th, and thought, art is the point. Yes, yes. Times are hard, and it's my responsibility to tell a story. It's my responsibility to gather people around the fire and unite us with a story. So I do think that in critical moments, art really does surge forward.
Yeah, and I'd like to ask you more about that. Why does it do that? Why does art create the space, the humane space, the human space that we need?
Because we're in a space where words fail us right now, where normal modes of communication do not feel large enough to encompass, represent how we are feeling, what we are going through as a nation. And we need art to step up and give us something that is bigger and in some ways just abstract enough to encompass all of us.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, I'm speaking with celebrated novelist Ann Patchett about a new annotated version of her 2001 novel, Bel Canto. And now let's talk about love and tenderness. This is such a theme, as we've already alluded to, in this annotated, well, in the original novel, Bel Canto, and you pointed out in the annotated version. In fact, the love was so great that you fell in love with your characters and got really depressed about what was going to happen to some of them. So I guess there's two questions there as well. First of all, talk about how love in some way, you know, how it becomes that central theme for you and how that's expressed in the book. I mean, here we have terrorists who have kidnapped a bunch of people, and yet the humanity of all the characters is so deeply explored. Talk about the love and tenderness in the characters, how you thought about bringing together, you know, what almost seems like a shocking thing, the love that develops between the captors and the captors and the captives.
Okay, I think that so much of the love comes from being freed from the normal responsibilities of life, that all of these people, they're very high powered, they're very, very busy, they're going, or they're the terrorists and they're very poor and they're very desperate and they're going. And then suddenly everyone stops and they are stuck in this place that is strange to all of them, except for the vice president who lives in the house. And they have an opportunity, some of them for the first time in their lives, to stop and examine their feelings. And what do they feel when they stop, when they look around and see each other? They feel love. The vice president feels this tremendous love for one of the children who's a terrorist. A lot of the terrorists are, by and large, teenagers. They're very young. But he takes one boy under his wing. The priest who stays takes one of the girls under his wing. The guy who's the Japanese businessman who never had enough time to play the piano suddenly has all day to play the piano. It's not that there's just one kind of love. There is romantic love in the book. But it's just a sweetness and appreciation of life and friendship that grows up between these people.
You know, so much we are locked into, you know, all kinds of divisions in this society, but one could say a sense that, you know, the terrorists are the bad men, you know, the bad guys. I remember how that term, the bad guys, came into being in so much common parlance after 9/11. There were bad guys all over the world, you know, and we can't even imagine thinking about it. There seems to be something almost, you know, traitorous to give them humanity. Could you talk about your own process in creating the humanity of these characters, these, quote, terrorists, unquote? What was some of the thinking behind you're being able to do that? And also, by the way, you know, characters who are incredibly privileged that we often don't think so nicely about.
Right. I think a lot of that just has to do with me as a person. I tend to see the good. I am positive and optimistic, and that is nothing except the way I was born. But I do believe that if you can cut one person out of a pack and sit down and spend time with them and really listen to them, you're going to find goodness in all of us. There was a book that was also published yesterday on November 6th by my friend Gregory Boyle, who is the founder of Homeboy Industries in Los Angeles, the world's largest gang prevention and rehabilitation program. And Greg is a Jesuit priest, and I think this is his fifth book. I've read them all. I'm a huge fan of his. And the new book is called Cherished Belonging, The Healing Power of Love in Divided Times. And this, I'm going to read you this because it's so great. The program Homeboy runs on two unwavering principles. Number one, we are all unshakably good, no exceptions. And number two, we belong to each other, no exceptions. That is a level of spiritual practice. You could spend your whole life on those two sentences. And Greg has spent his whole life working with gang members, many of whom have spent most of their lives in prison for horrible crimes, and they come out and they come to Homeboy. And this is what he knows for sure. We are all good, no exceptions.
You know, I practice, or I try to practice, Buddhist precepts, which I think those would fit very well within. But I really struggle when it comes to people who I feel have the greatest privileges in this society and who use it to harm people and put them down and be cruel to them. And I think we can all think of the prime exemplar of that who was just reelected on Tuesday. How do you see people like that? I guess I can understand a gang member better. I can understand a terrorist who comes from a poor family. I'm not sure I can feel the same way about billionaires who use their power for evil.
Yeah, it is really a challenge. But all I know is if I believe that we are all connected, we are all of one life, we are all deserving of love and forgiveness. It's not like we are all deserving of love and forgiveness except the guy who runs you off the road with his Bentley. You know, it is really hard. It's really hard. But it's kind of like how I stay alive. I don't know.
Oh, I like that. How to stay alive. Say more about that.
Well, my whole mantra that I've been talking about throughout this election is nobody can have my sanity. You can have my money, you can have my vote, you can have my work. I will do everything I can do, but you cannot have my peace of mind. Absolutely nothing is going to get my peace of mind. I do not want to be someone who lies awake all night and ruminates on how horrible other people are. I will control what I can control. I will do what I can do. I will do the best I can do. I will assume there are all sorts of things I don't understand, like how more than half of the country voted for a person who is a criminal, you know, who's a convicted criminal. There are things I do not know and experiences that I have not lived. And the only way I can go forward is with as much kindness and good work as I'm capable of. And I feel like anyone listening to this right now is rolling their eyes and thinking, what an incredibly naive Pollyanna this one is. But you know what? That's where I am. That's where I'm coming from.
Well, you know, just this morning, I actually said something very similar to myself. I said, In a time where evil seems ascendant, it's my job to create kindness and compassion and love every moment that I can be aware of doing so.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And, you know, one of the things that I love about living in Tennessee, which is a red state that I don't think is ever going to change. It's a disaster down here. We have open carry, which means that you go into a restaurant and you see a 20-year-old guy with a handgun tied to his upper thigh, which always makes me want to say, what, dude, you couldn't put it in your belt? Like, you don't want to have to bend your elbow if you're going to shoot somebody. We have book banning. We have everything from dog catcher to governor is Republican. And yet, I know so many people who are wonderful, wonderful people who voted differently from the way I voted. People who would have my back no matter what. People who would always come through for me. People who I would always come through for. And we have really different political views. And they are very good people. And that makes me feel really fortunate, because I think that the problem is when you think that there is an other and you don't know them. There's an other, but I do know them. And a lot of them are great.
And in Bel Canto, I guess that's really what happens.
Yes. It's the other, but you're stuck in a room with them until you get to know them. They've got guns in your face, and you're stuck in a room with them until you get to know them. And what do you find out? They're actually like you.
Mm. Well, it's been such a privilege to talk with you, Ann Patchett, and such a privilege to read this book. I had not read it before.
Oh, that's fun.
It is fun. And, you know, you caution people to read the original first and then read this because this will slow you down. Well, slowing me down was just wonderful. I got to savor this and to savor it from a perspective that made it all the more meaningful.
Oh, that's so nice. I'm really glad to hear it. It's funny. It's a funny thing to get old and to think that this book that for a while everyone I knew had read Bel Canto and now not so much. You know, people will say, oh, I read Tom Lake. Wait, you had that other book? What was that? Bel Canto? What? And I think, oh, this is great. It's really great to evolve past a work that seems like you're never going to get away from it. And people go on and see you in other ways.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ann Patchett is the best-selling author of 9 novels, 4 works of fiction, and other literary works. She's received numerous awards, including a National Humanities Medal and the Penn Faulkner Award. Next up, we talk with Kathy Engel about her poetry, activism, and growing up on the East End of Long Island. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. Kathy Engel has long combined her work as a writer, poet, and activist. For over 40 years, she's worked in many of the major social justice, peace, and human rights movements of our time. She co-founded such organizations as the International Women's Human Rights Group, MADRE, East End groups advocating justice for Palestinian rights and peace in the Middle East, and with the poet Alexis DeVoe, the organizations Lyrical Democracies and the Center for Poetic Healing. This rich history informs her latest book of poems, Dear Inheritors. It moves from the intimacy of home and family to community to social movement to other countries and back to the beauty of the natural world on Long Island's South Shore. Engels' poems raise questions of personal responsibility, what we owe to each other, and how we nourish our spirits. Writer's Voice spoke with her last in 2014 about the poetry anthology she co-edited with Kamal Bulata, We Begin Here, Poems for Palestinians and Lebanon. Kathy Engel, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca. I'm delighted to be here.
The title poem, and I actually want you to read it, but I want to save it for last because I think it's a wonderful poem to read. But it made me think, just the title itself, that this is a volume in some ways written to our children, writ large, not necessarily our biological children, but to the generations that come. Is that so?
I think so. I mean, I think it's written to all of us, but yes, it's a musing. I think getting to a point of musing about a life and also who came before and who might be coming, and also my children, anyone's children, and the young people I am privileged to work with who inspire me so much and fill me with a sense of possibility when otherwise I might not feel it. So yes, I think that's true. But I think for me, the writing to the next generation is also looking back as well.
And looking back, it's a long poem, so I won't ask you to read it, although we may quote from it. But let's start with the poem, Where I Live. I loved so many poems in this book, but this one, of course, so special because we both live in the same area, the east end of Long Island. You live in Bridgehampton, New York. And this is very much a look back at the place where you grew up and that you then later on in life came back to. And you came back to live in contradiction, as you write. First of all, you talk about Bridgehampton, the place where you grew up, as a place where you learned to hide your fear. What did you mean by that?
What do I mean by that? I think the fear of one's own fear, the fear of one's own culpability, the fear of really living with what you see and then figuring out what to do about what you see. And in my case, I think the fear of the intensity of my feelings, you know.
There's a phrase, the bold glare of contradiction and old plantation segregation. Very much in this poem, there's a contrast between the stunning beauty and repose and restoration that the environment, the natural environment offers, with deeply fractured and dysfunctional social relations. So first talk about those social relations, the racism, the classism here, and then that contrast with the stunning beauty of the area.
You know, I've always found a contrast between the beauty of earth and tree and sea and the violence in the world, and specifically human-made violence. But that's not the only violence, but that's the one I'm pretty focused on. And so I've always found that. I mean, when I went to Nicaragua in 1983 and was actually traveling through a war zone, and then I would look out at these fields, and this is kind of a cliche. I think it's not an uncommon thing, but I just was like, what? This is so beautiful. And then I could actually picture, see the bones and the blood, and I heard all the stories. So, but coming home, you know, it's a class conflict and a conflict with myself about what I was coming home with or to, and how in some ways unmanageable it is. And it's also understanding in my journey to really look at whiteness, look at privilege. Not, you know, you can say you're anti-racist, and I had certain points in my life which were absolute, like, turning points, turning and never go back points. One was when I met the white Southern anti-racist activist Ann Braden in 1981 and heard her speak about her journey. Just changed me. I went back. I was living in the city at the time and got off boards and said, I will do this, I won't do this. And but to be living in a place where it's racism is synonymous with the United States, but to be in a place where it's so stark, and having been looking back at what I saw when I grew up, I mean, I'm grateful for what I learned. I mean, I'm actually getting tight in the chest just talking about it, and I'm 68 years old. You know, I'm grateful for what I saw and then being able to return to it. And I guess it's about what I think poetry is about, at least for me. I mean, it's about language, it's about lyric, it's about craft, but it's also about looking a way of engaging with truths and discomforts and realities and also imaginings that you might not otherwise be able to, or at least not in that way. And so that's been my journey and my kind of insistence to myself.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and we're talking with poet and activist Kathy Engel about her latest book of poems, Dear Inheritors. Give us some description of that. I mean, when you were a child is when you first understood. Your stepfather was a farmer, as I understand, and, you know, during harvest time, he would hire Black people who lived in the area to reap, you know, to harvest the crops, and you would go out and help. So talk about when you first discovered that divide.
Yeah, they were seasonal workers for the most part, although numbers of families stayed and had been staying for a long time. I had this mixed complex reality, which is one, I developed this conversation, and I was a kid, you know, with the people who were picking the potatoes. And it wasn't a very wordy conversation, but it was a very, well, there we were outside, and I was a kid, and they were teaching me things. And I liked the physicality. Also, I always liked learning about people. Then when I went with my stepfather to take some people home sometimes is when I had the real awakening of how differently people were living and what that there was. It was like a wall. You know, we talk about walls being constructed, but there was a wall. It just happened to be a train track. And, you know, that I didn't hear anybody talking about it. So I just, there it was in me. And the other thing is that, you know, I never talked to my stepfather about these things. He wasn't a verbal person. He was a very smart person, very smart, but he wasn't verbal. He wasn't a reader. He was a farmer, and which doesn't mean you're not a reader, but he was of that generation of farmers who were here. However, I knew because we had a special bond, but I learned later after his death, I complicated my own sense, my own ideological analysis about race and class and structure, that he was so beloved and by the people who worked with him. And I mean, in a very real way, because people would come up to me unsolicited and say, oh, that was your stepfather. You were related to Bud Topping. He was the kindest person I ever knew. Now, that's, you know, that's a lot to say about someone, but it really made me think about how I judged things in terms of undoing racism, identifying one's complicity in any bad thing, you know. So there was that. And then there was my relationship with the earth and with animals, which just filled me with comfort and love and sense of connection. And there were things I experienced in school, in elementary school, which were horrible. And I witnessed some really violent actions by white teachers towards Black youth. So there were all those things happening when I was very young. Coming back, then I was in a whole different place in my life. Obviously, I had been in social movements for years. I'd been organizing. I'd been writing. So I saw things with an even more complex lens. And then I had to find out, what was I doing here? Why? And I know why I came back, but and what was I to do with that? There was something something very difficult, because it'd be easier not to deal with it, to come back with that identity.
You also express in these poems, Kathy Engel, in Dear Inheritors, you express struggling with privilege, white skin privilege, but also you were the other in your school. You were the only Jewish kid in your school. So often being a little bit on the margins of a group in which you are still acknowledged as a member can be really a way to see more clearly into what is going on. So share with us how you even today struggle with the privilege of being white, what you learned from, you know, working in the movements that you have, because I think that sensibility comes through in these poems. And, you know, sometimes I'm not so sure I can trust somebody who's white. Kind of, I'm wondering how much they're virtue signaling versus how much they really struggle with this. And in these poems, I feel like I can see the truth behind your struggle.
Okay, what's the question?
How you struggle, what are some of your thoughts on white skin privilege and how people deal with it and how you deal with it in a way that's really authentic and not kind of, you know, just trying to pretend you're being something you're not?
Well, I think it's constant, you know. I was at a conference when I was very young, or a gathering with Bill Kunstler, who was a friend, the attorney, the civil rights attorney. And Bill was kind of blustery and brilliant. And it was a conference on racism in movements. And there were some other cultural workers there. And it was, I think, the Center for Constitutional Rights called it. And at one point, Bill said, well, you know, something like, and I'm paraphrasing because I'm not quoting directly. It was a long time ago. But he said, it stuck with me, something like, listen, you know, because there was a lot of white angst going on. And then it was a mixed room. And it was a classic kind of experience where then the people of color have to be the kind of the babysitters and the teachers for the white guilty people. But Bill, who was not that guilty person, he was just deeply dedicated and fierce and clear. And he said, you know, it's in the mother's milk. It's everywhere. This is this country. So we have, what are we going to do and how are we going to do it? So I always thought of that, the way he said that. And I think when I was young, once I became even more aware, I was inclined, and you're right, I did feel like other in my life. And that was very personal, I have a feeling, having to do with my parents' divorce and identification and being pulled. Even though they were both white Jewish people, they Jewish identified people, but they were very different. And I think it was like city, country, more bourgeois, much less bourgeois, you know, all of the activists, more social work, very. And I think I never felt like I belonged anywhere, except I felt I belonged in poetry, and I felt I belonged once I got involved with movements. To a degree. I mean, I felt a great sense of community and sometimes even euphoria working with community and struggle. However, that has its own challenges, particularly for an introvert and a poet and an artist, I think, or just maybe for anyone. But it's interesting that I didn't only feel other at that school, although I certainly did feel other there. Honestly, I tended to hang out with the Black kids. And that wasn't it just sort of happened. It wasn't only exclusively some decision. It just sort of happened. But I never understood these categories of separation. I just never did. I never understood nationalism, really, although I grew to understand it ideologically as like a phase that often groups of people have to go through to claim what's been taken or threatened. But I never understood, you know, this notion of superiority. Although, as many of us do, I come from both sides of my family in different ways, very judgmental, even though they wouldn't actually say it like that, that there's a better way to do things in a worse way. And you try to be the best at what you do. So that hierarchical competitive, which is hand in hand with high capitalism, it all complicates, because I also moved away from that But for myself, I initially wanted to be the just perfect anti-racist white person. That's what I craved. And then I grew to understand that that was like not real and actually deeply problematic. But I forgave myself for it because it's not that I did anything terrible. I just wasn't as fully honest with myself because it's a lifelong struggle. But that's beautiful, I think. It's uncomfortable and beautiful because you're constantly learning. And it took me a long time to learn to be publicly and even privately vulnerable. I thought I had to be tough. I thought I had to know things. And particularly, I thought I knew emotional things. And there were some very personal things that happened that had nothing to do with any of that, that kind of brought me to my knees later. And, you know, as a grown woman, mother, working person for many years, that helped me to understand or come to feel that my own vulnerability and engagement with the hard parts of my story or the uncomfortable, squirmy parts was maybe the gift. I don't think you can look at any of these inequities, but certainly the disease and crime really of how white supremacy has worked in this country, works in this country, without, you know, really constantly, particularly as a white identified person, constantly challenging oneself. You can still have a sense of humor. You have joy because your world is always expanding.
Yeah, and it's this appreciation, I think, of contradiction that I love so much in the poems in this book, Dear Inheritors. You know, Kathy Engel, I mean, contradiction is a fact of life and the spice of life, too. And there is a poem I'd like to have you read that I think expresses some of the things that we've been talking about just in the last few minutes. It's on page 11. It's Unmarked Graves of Indigenous Children, 2021. You know, would you mind reading the poem?
I would love to. Thank you for asking, because I actually don't read this poem very often. So, mm-hmm. Unmarked Graves of Indigenous Children, 2021. There's an epigraph, which is a quote from Smithsonian Magazine, June 28th, 2021. 751 unmarked graves discovered near former Indigenous school in Canada. Experts estimate 4,000 to 10,000 children may have died at the schools, often from a combination of poor living conditions and disease. And then in brackets, since 2021, more bodies have been found on sites of additional former boarding schools, including in the U.S. Some children ran away and froze to death. There are two sections in the poem. Just read the numbers. One, I will not write a poem over the graves of children, the invisible calligraphy of their lives. Small bone song rested into no zone. No lyric from soil composted with veins and seeds. Gouging grammar kidnaps first truth of a child from their body. No metaphor lifts the mother's ache. Blasphemy of naming, sorting, discarding the young for slaughter. Some species kill to survive. Mine for what? Never again say, be more human, humane, unless you mean brutal. Two, to honor the children, I will study the snail in its trail, democracy of birds in flight, the way trees converse, and I'll more than hug the tree, will stroke and hold as long as I can, awkward, unknowing, reverent, mother of all mimosas growing in all directions, pink puffs so luscious they could gag a cynic. Give me a language for the stem that loves the root fully, the root that holds the stem with all that is sacred.
Such a beautiful poem, and one that, again, there's that juxtaposition of the healing of the earth with the injustice of what people do to each other.
Yeah, what are we going to do about that?
Exactly. And when you said, don't talk of humane unless you mean brutal, it's like, boy, I get that. I get that. Every time people use that word humane, for years I've thought, yeah, well, humane ain't so great. Maybe we ought to say, oh, that's so bird-like or something. And
Or at least the best, if you're saying human or humane as something that is more tender and more thoughtful and more compassionate, then maybe we could say the best of human, because certainly we know very well, very horribly well, the worst of human, and we're seeing it right now in such devastating ways. You would think that humans would learn. And we learn so much, we learn about medical things. We learn, we learn about all these contraptions that we communicate with or go to the moon with or whatever we do, save time with. But to learn to live together is, and to live together with all the beings, we haven't learned that. We have to keep going back to square one. So, I guess, that's what this book is, I guess. Really, it's me coming to terms with what I have and haven't learned, and what I feel I have, don't, and do have to offer. And I mean, in recognizing all the unknowns of that, I did move into a much more of a spiritual place in the years of that most of these pieces were written. It was really hard, though, in this current period to hold that, because I just felt raw and driven and just the activist.
Kathy Engel co-founded East End for Peace with her daughter Ella Engel Snow. She teaches at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts, Department of Art and Public Policy, and the master's program in arts politics. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows. Plus, find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. Stay connected with Writer's Voice. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just search on Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.